Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is turmoil in Jerusalem. With me to discuss the rising tensions between Israelis and Palestinians is Stephen Cook. Stephen is the ENI Enrico Mattei Senior Fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. His most recent book is False Dawn, Protest, Democracy, and Violence in the New Middle East. He also writes a twice-a-month column at foreignpolicy.com. Stephen, thanks for being here.
It's a great pleasure to be back with you, Jim.
Well, Stephen, it's obviously a fluid story, what's happening in Jerusalem in recent days. Can you sort of bring us up to speed as to what's happening?
Yeah, you know, everybody's kind of focused on what's happened this week with Jerusalem Day and the holiest night of the month of Ramadan that really sparked violence in and around the Old City and on the Haram al-Sharif or Temple Mount. But tensions in Jerusalem have been rising for at least the last month. There are TikTok videos of Palestinian young people attacking Israeli Jews on public transportation. And then there was a march of right-wing Israelis through Jerusalem, protesters screaming, "Arabs, get out, death to the Arabs." That's not necessarily something that's so unusual, but nevertheless, they've really raised the tensions. And then, of course, it's been the month of Ramadan, and the Israeli police, for some reason, have prevented Palestinians from gathering in and around Damascus Gate, which is one of the main gates in and out of the Old City and a direct route to Al-Aqsa. So it's been a really tough month. And then, of course, you have added to it, a court has permitted Israelis to take over homes in the East Jerusalem neighborhood called Sheikh Jarrah on the premise that this was land that had been inhabited by Jews prior to 1948 and that Jews are just reclaiming property there. And this means the forced eviction of six Palestinian families. So all of this has come together in the last couple of weeks and has produced violence in the streets of Jerusalem. And now we have rocket attacks from the Gaza Strip onto Jerusalem as well as other cities in Israel.
And I will note that the Israeli Air Force has retaliated with airstrikes, which I think at last count had killed 26 people, including some children.
Right, including 9 children.
I want to go back to the sort of the setting of the conflict and the recent tension. You mentioned Haram al-Sharif, the Temple Mount, Al-Aqsa Mosque. Can you put it in context for people, the significance of these places?
The Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Golden Dome of the Rock, which, you know, famous around the world, is the third holiest site in Islam and the place where the Prophet Muhammad allegedly took his night flight from. It sits on the area where the temple in Jerusalem is. When people go to the Western Wall, that's the last remaining piece of the temple. It's a retaining wall around this, what's called the Temple Mount, where the temple stood.
And just to be clear, which temple, Stephen?
This is the second temple, the holiest site in all of Judaism. And so you have over the years and more recently, as the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has courted groups further to the right than him and his Likud party, you have had Israelis who want to rebuild the temple, destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock to rebuild the temple and assert Israeli sovereignty over the Temple Mount Haram al-Sharif. Since 1967, there has been a very delicate balance between Israeli authorities, Palestinian religious authorities, and Jordanian religious authorities to kind of keep a semblance of order and peace and smooth functioning administration of the mosque and the Dome of the Rock that has generally kept Israelis from praying on the Temple Mount, the holiest site for Judaism, which obviously rankles these ultra-nationalist and religious groups that want to rebuild the temple. And it has, from time to time, the Temple Mount Haram al-Sharif and the Western Wall have become a flashpoint for violence between Palestinians and Israelis. In the previous two intifadas, the second intifada in particular.
You may want to explain what the intifada was for people who either haven't heard of it or don't remember.
Intifada is the Arabic word for uprising or throwing off. And there have been two previous intifadas, one that broke out in the late 1980s and another one that broke out in the early 2000s. The one in the early 2000s, the proximate cause of the violence that then went on for a number of years was then Israeli leader Ariel Sharon's visit to the Haram al-Sharif. Ariel Sharon, although a hero in Israeli politics and a war hero, is someone who has a lot of Arab blood on his hands. And this was seen as a very, very provocative act on Sharon's part, which contributed to the violence of the Second Intifada after the failure, essentially, of the Oslo Accords, which was these agreements between Israel and the PLO to negotiate peace through the 1990s that really came to nothing. So this central point in Jerusalem has been a source of violence and tension. And I think that people shouldn't be surprised by what's been happening. Although there has been a lull over the course of the last 6 or 7 years, tension has been simmering as the Israelis tighten their grip on Jerusalem, building in and around it to kind of close off the possibility that Jerusalem be a shared capital, one for Palestine and one for Israel.
So let's talk a bit about the origins. To what extent, Stephen, in your view, are these tensions sort of bubbling up from the bottom? And to what extent they are orchestrated or driven by groups?
It seems to me, based on everything that we can tell, that this is really driven from the bottom. That you have a moribund Palestinian leadership in the form of the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah that was supposed to have Palestinian elections, but polls showed that the Fatah faction of the PLO, led by Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, known as Abu Mazen, would not win, that Hamas, the Islamic Resistance Movement, would win, and they have postponed those elections. Fatah and the Palestinian Authority really lost young people in the Palestinian areas. And this tension has been building. Jerusalem is already a tense place, but as the Israelis have continued, as I mentioned before, to tighten their grip on the city, continue to extend settlements and infrastructure out into the West Bank, the only conclusion that people can draw is that this occupation is a permanent one, that there is no time horizon, there is no political horizon for the Palestinians to realize their dream of a Palestinian state and their rights. And this is a place where, amazingly, in Jerusalem, people tend to either get out of each other's way or have gotten along, but it's not a cliche to say that the tension is really below the surface. And again, with ultra-nationalist Israelis marching through the streets, first in April, demanding that Arabs get out or calling for death to the Arabs, you have Palestinian youth attacking Israelis in and around the Old City. This is something that is bound to flare up. When it's mixed with Jerusalem Day, which is the Israeli celebration of the capture of Jerusalem and the eastern portion of Jerusalem in the June 1967 war, which happened this past Monday, this was all bound up together that was likely to create violence. It was something that you can feel when you're in Jerusalem.
Well, Stephen, you mentioned the First Intifada and the Second Intifada. So I want to ask you a question that Tom Friedman posed in his New York Times column today. Is this the big one? And I think by that he meant perhaps the Third Intifada. Is that the point we're at right now?
It's a good question. And I think Tom Friedman posed it because it's obviously front and center. Anybody who's looked at this conflict over the years has been predicting a Third Intifada eventually because there really has been no movement. I think one of the reasons why there's the possibility of a Third Intifada is that you have a number of different political actors who are going to benefit from a prolonged convulsion of violence between Israelis and Palestinians. First, Mahmoud Abbas, who has kind of lost, as I said, Palestinian population. Hamas, which is now lobbing rockets into Israel, which is flexing its muscle in a bid for leadership, in a bid to kind of put the nail in Mahmoud Abbas's political coffin. And Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who is fighting for his political survival. Israel has just gone through 4 elections, has not been able to come up with a workable coalition. And that if the violence continues, it may encourage Israeli political factions to either have a national unity government with Netanyahu at top of it, or decide this is not the time for change. The kind of legend of Netanyahu is that he is the provider of security. The normalcy that the Israelis have experienced and enjoyed over the course of his premiership, which is now 12 years long, is a result of his policies. And so he made very strong statements about a swift and strong response to what Hamas has done and what the Israeli police are going to do in Jerusalem to reestablish order. So I think you have a vector of 3 different sets of politicians who actually benefit from this. So no one's going to come in and kind of de-escalate, referee this. The Biden administration doesn't seem to have an appetite to engage in, you know, the kind of diplomacy to push the sides apart. So it could very well be that we're in for a period of prolonged violence, or we could see some sort of repeat of the Gaza war from 2014, which, you know, the stakes in that conflict.
Why don't you refresh people's memory of the Gaza war in 2014?
In 2014, there was violence between Israelis and Palestinians, kidnap of Israelis, violence against Palestinians, and it turned into a war over the summer of 2014. As terrible as that was, the stakes here are far greater. I mean, it's about Jerusalem. It's about identity. It's about history, about can the Israelis forcibly evict Palestinians from Sheikh Jarrah?
Now, Sheikh Jarrah is a neighborhood in East Jerusalem, correct?
Right. The neighborhood in East, which is one of the issues that's bound up in this current convulsion of violence, is this forced eviction of six families from this neighborhood in East Jerusalem. These kinds of things happen all the time, but they're coming at this moment, which coincides with Jerusalem Day and this increasing tension. And this is because it's Jerusalem and a neighborhood in Jerusalem that Jews lay claim to, that Palestinians lay claim to, and because of the violence on Al-Aqsa, the stakes seem to be much higher now than they were during the Gaza War in 2014. So we could either be looking at a third intifada, or we could be looking at another convulsion. Already the Israelis are calling up reservists to deal with the situation in Gaza. So it seems like either of Tom Friedman's options at this point seem possible.
You've spoken about what's happening in Israel and in the West Bank and Gaza. What are the reactions been, Stephen, in Arab capitals? I'll note that neighboring Jordan clearly has a big stake in what happens in Israel and in the territories. We've just gone through several years of negotiating the Abraham Accords, which were held up as a different route to getting toward Middle East peace. What are we hearing from places like Amman and Abu Dhabi and Riyadh?
It's an interesting dynamic because one of the things that both the Trump administration said, as well as the Emiratis and their partners in the Abraham Accords, was that this was actually a step towards resolving the core conflict between Israelis and Palestinians because the Abraham Accords was alleged to have stopped Israeli annexation of territories. It has not done so. The Emiratis have issued three statements calling for restraint, condemning the violence, and calling for the upholding of the sanctity of the Haram Sharif, the mosque and the Dome of the Rock, but haven't done much more than that. The Saudi Ministry of Foreign Affairs released a statement today expressing support for the Palestinian people. Again, the sanctity of the Haram Sharif, you know, condemning the Israelis for the violence and occupying of the Haram Sharif, and calling for the implementation of the Arab Peace Initiative, which is a peace initiative that the Saudis tabled way back in 2002 under King Abdullah. That has been their line throughout. Beyond that, they don't seem willing to engage in the kind of diplomacy that would be necessary to pull these sides apart. And I suspect that if they are, they're waiting for the Biden administration to take the lead on this. And we'll have to see how things go in Israel and the Palestinian areas, and Gaza in particular. Jordan is particularly concerned about any kind of significant violence in Jerusalem, given the demographics of Jordan, which is a majority, it's Jordan, but majority of the people who live in Jordan are actually traced their lineage back to Palestine. You know, there hasn't been a census, but the going figures is plus 60% of the Jordanian population is actually Palestinian. And it's a very delicate balance for King Abdullah to manage this. He happens to be married to a woman who is Palestinian. It's very, very difficult for them because they don't want to be overwhelmed by and that violence spill over into Jordan, which could threaten the ruling family, the Hashemites in Jordan. So thus far, leaders in the region have been willing to allow the Israelis and the Palestinians to come to blows while issuing statements of concern and condemning violence, but not much more than that.
I didn't ask you about one Arab capital that I should have asked you about, Stephen, and that's Cairo. Any word from President Sisi in reaction to this?
Not yet. The Egyptians are sort of in strategic hibernation. They have looked inward and determined that they need to take care of Egypt to assume their traditional role as regional leader. However, if the violence in Gaza really escalates and the Israelis introduce ground troops into Gaza, you can very well expect people to turn to the Egyptians to engineer some sort of ceasefire between the Israelis and Hamas. The Egyptians have done a lot of work in Gaza, primarily because they want to keep Gaza locked up and closed down. They see Gaza as a threat to their security as well.
How so, Stephen?
Well, you know, it's no secret that the Egyptian government looks at the Muslim Brotherhood and all Islamists as a threat. The coup in Egypt was to overthrow a Muslim Brotherhood elected president in Egypt. And Hamas is an outgrowth of the Palestine branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. It's not only that, the Egyptians fear that the Israeli solution to the Gaza Strip is to throw it back into the lap of Egypt. Egypt was the power in the Gaza Strip prior to the 1967 war. With Israel's victory in 1967, it assumed responsibility for the Gaza Strip. It's like, from the Israeli perspective, it's the poison chalice. And at any number of points, the Israelis have mused about an Arab solution to Gaza. That makes the Egyptians very worried that when someone says Arab solution to Gaza, that means Egyptian solution to Gaza. So Egyptians are likely to get involved as violence escalates in the Gaza Strip. Any previous period of violence, no matter how long, the Egyptians have been instrumental in finding a ceasefire. We may very well see more Egyptian diplomacy if it becomes an actual shooting war between Hamas and Israel in the Gaza Strip.
So should my takeaway from this, Stephen, be that the Israeli government, which essentially is a caretaker government right now, if I understand it correctly, as they try to see if they can form a stable coalition government to take office, and that may or may not happen, hence the potential call for, I guess, fifth election in 2 years, or a little more than 2 years. But from that vantage point, is it safe to say the Israeli government's operating in a relatively permissive environment, given the constellation of interest in the region? It has a little bit of wiggle room?
It does have a little bit of wiggle room, I suspect, until the Biden administration gets involved.
Okay.
Thus far, the Biden administration has issued a statement of concern and calling on all sides and saying Israel has a right to defend itself. But it's a less permissive environment than perhaps it was under the Trump administration.
So let's talk then about the Biden administration. And I think it's safe to say that the Biden administration sought to de-emphasize the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and I would say the U.S. role in the Middle East more broadly. Again, that's partly because Joe Biden wants to concentrate his attention on what he calls job one, dealing with China, which he sees as a far greater threat to U.S. interests. But my sense is it's also because he and his advisors don't see a potential to make much progress because the Israelis and the Palestinians are so far apart. And I think some of the steps the administration has taken so far seem to bear out that analysis. My understanding is the Biden administration is yet to nominate an ambassador to Israel. It hasn't followed the tradition of recent American presidencies of nominating a special envoy for Middle East peace. And I have read that the portfolio, at least until recently, for Middle East peace in the U.S. government was handled by a deputy assistant secretary of state, which is fairly low down the hierarchy as far as diplomatic prestige goes. So is that a fair summary of how the Biden administration is approaching that to begin with?
It's spot on, Jim. I think that as vice president, Joe Biden saw the efforts to forge negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians come to essentially nothing, just a source of frustration for two secretaries of state and President Obama, and doesn't see the benefit of it. And that is how they have pursued. As you point out, there's no Middle East peace envoy. I think an Israeli ambassador will be named soon, but not likely to take up a spot until this coming summer. And you're quite right. The Israel-Palestine portfolio in the nearest bureau of the State Department is being handled by a deputy assistant secretary throughout the government. There's nobody identifiable at the National Security Council who's handling Arab-Israeli issues. There's no one at the policy planning staff who's specifically working on Palestinian-Israeli issues. So there has been a clear effort to downgrade this issue as well as the region more broadly.
Okay, well, the question then becomes whether the downgrade is tenable given current circumstances.
Right.
But let's talk a little bit about this, because it seems to me that the Biden administration is going to feel cross-pressured in a way. On the one hand, the Biden administration clearly wants to find a way to get back into the Iran nuclear deal as a beginning to make it longer and stronger, to borrow the phrase the administration likes to use, which means that it needs to find a way to work with Israel because the Israelis are quite critical, certainly under Prime Minister Netanyahu, opposed to reviving the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action as it's formerly known. And the Israelis on that point have a lot of support in the United States Congress, not just among Republicans, but but also among Democrats. And I would also note, on the other hand, that Joe Biden faces a Democratic Party in which a growing number of voices are critical of Israel and how it has handled the Palestinian issue. We tend to think of people like Bernie Sanders, obviously made a lot of news on the campaign trail when he's campaigning for president, but Elizabeth Warren, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and others, but even senators you might not think of, like Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen, which recently came out with a tweet calling on the administration to put the rule of law and human rights at the forefront of its foreign policy. And as a result, this is not a time for tepid statements. So how do you see the Biden administration navigating these cross pressures at the same time where they really want to focus on is China?
I think this is going to be the dilemma for them. If the violence continues in Jerusalem, they will be forced to address this issue, and something that they absolutely clearly do not want to address. And there will be political pressure for them to be tough on the Israelis, not just from the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, but as you point out, Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen, who's, you know, a moderate Democrat, others who are looking at this and saying, you know, the Israelis may have gone really too far here in terms of a permanent occupation slash annexation and the way in which they have dealt with the Palestinian population. This is all coming on the heels of a major 224-page report from Human Rights Watch saying that Israel, they didn't call it an apartheid state, but the policies that the Israelis have pursued in the occupied Palestinian territories, Gaza Strip, and Israel proper meets the definition of apartheid and persecution, which are crimes against humanity. Whatever you people want to think about Human Rights Watch, this is having an impact on the way people think about the conflict. So that's one issue for them. Then, as you point out, the Biden administration wants to have this negotiation with Iran, explore ways of getting back into the JCPOA or a new agreement. Despite the statements coming from Israelis and American officials about open communication and being on the same page and so on and so forth, the word on the street is that the Israelis are super unhappy with the direction of the negotiations, that they believe that the Biden administration is too eager to get back into an agreement that threatens Israeli security. So should Biden get involved in the situation that's unfolding in Jerusalem and Gaza right now, which doesn't want to get involved in, with pressure from the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, at the same time that they are looking to get back into the JCPOA, you can expect that the trust between the two governments may not be where one would like it in order to kind of pull the Israelis and the Palestinians apart and then move forward with the JCPOA. You know, all of this discussion about de-emphasizing the Middle East, withdrawing from the Middle East, I think it was President Obama who said, it's like in The Godfather. It just keeps pulling you back in. And here we are, it's not even 125 days, or maybe it's 125 days, and it's really likely to pull Biden back in. But there's no joy here. You know, the Israelis and Palestinians keep going up to the abyss, and everybody expects them to step back, and they seem to hold hands and jump in together and wait for people to come in and separate them. But the situation never gets better. You never go back to a status quo ante. You get to some point where the situation calms down, but the Israelis continue their policies that have dispossessed Palestinians, that make it harder to imagine a two-state solution. The Palestinians become more fractious, more factionalized. The people themselves become poorer, more desperate, and groups like Hamas or Palestinian Islamic Jihad tend to benefit from this.
In terms of the Israeli policies you're referring to, those are the policies that are discussed by Human Rights Watch in its 200-plus page report. And I should note, you have a column at foreignpolicy.com, I think on May 6th, sort of assessing the Human Rights Watch report. But I want to actually ask you about what it is that so-called progressive Democrats are expecting the Biden administration to do on Israel in terms of its treatment of the Palestinians, both in terms of what are the specific steps, and to what extent does the United States really have leverage over, let's say, at least a Netanyahu government or a right-of-center government issue, which has really been the case, as you've mentioned, for the last dozen years?
Because this is such an important issue politically for many people, you have to separate out the exhortation to what people are actually calling for. And up until this point, there's been a range of ideas. One is to condition Israel's military aid based on its behavior towards Palestinians. The other is further to the left, I should say, is to essentially end the military aid to Israel because it is pursuing policies that meet the definition of apartheid and persecution. And why would the United States?
But wouldn't it be really difficult to do that in a situation in which Hamas is firing rockets at Israeli cities? That seems to me to be a very tough argument to make.
That is the reasonable response to this. But I think that in some cases, without actually saying it, the Hamas rocket fire on Israel is sort of minimized and say, well, you know, this rocket fire on Gaza is a result of the fact that the Israelis maintain Gaza as essentially an open-air prison. prison, and what are the Palestinians expected to do, especially if the Israelis are using their air force to bomb Gaza and, you know, killing 24 people, 9 of whom are children, et cetera, et cetera. So the idea is to use our leverage, and our leverage lies in the copious amounts of aid that the United States provides to Israel in order to modify Israeli behavior. You know, lots of people in our world talk about leverage, and I've always thought that this was sort of half-baked, because you only have leverage if you use it, and it's really only one bullet in the chamber. Once you do it, then what's next?
Especially if it fails.
Especially if it fails. And I think that the Biden administration may want to, if it were to go down that road, it would find a lot of opposition in Congress. It is true that the progressive wing seems to be ascending. More and more members of Congress are willing to call the Israelis out for their human rights violations and other policies. But in general, Israel remains popular, and the default position for many people in Congress is to continue to support Israel. So barring the use of that leverage through the military assistance program, which, by the way, the United States collaborates and benefits from, it is the United States getting involved in this kind of thankless diplomacy to try to bring some sort of stability to the situation. Who could even possibly imagine an actual peace negotiation given the current state of things? So it's more of a kind of triage diplomacy, which is called for here. One of the things I wrote about the Human Rights Watch report is that it is morally damning. You know, they marshal a tremendous amount of evidence to support the argument. And whether you want to agree, whether you want to call it apartheid or not, it is a terrible situation. And the Israelis have essentially dehumanized this population. But the fact of the matter is that Israel remains important to the United States for a variety of reasons, politically, strategically, from a moral and historical perspective. It remains popular. It's also well integrated into the international economy. Every major multinational company is in Israel, doing business in Israel. They have tech centers in Israel. It's going to be very, very hard to make Israel a pariah that countries made South Africa in the 1980s.
Well, particularly when Arab capitals have made peace deals with the Israelis, right?
Exactly. You know, the Emiratis and the Bahrainis and others may have made statements about what's happening, but they are not interested in taking any kind of punitive action against the Israelis. The Saudis, who have remained steadfast that they will not normalize relations with Israel until the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians, issued a statement from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs that basically says, we uphold the Arab Peace Initiative of 2002. I mean, you can't get more equivocal than that in a diplomatic statement. And I think this is what the Israelis are counting on. And they're saying, you know, look, this is our capital, and we have every reason to build and police it as we see fit. You know, mind your own business.
On that note, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Stephen Cook, a senior fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Stephen, thank you for joining me.
Thanks, Jim.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Anna Shortridge for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.